The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Yarns by Susan Palwick. Inevitably, they found her. She came back to her tiny apartment and clicked on the light to find a massive young man wearing the signature black jeans and sweatshirt of Combine standing in her living room. The dim light glinted off his earpiece, the net chips embedded on his cheek, the barrel of his gun. The gun was some kind of high-tech semi-automatic. Of course, it was pointed at her. As often as Irene had imagined the moment, she yelped and panicked and dropped her bags, sending crimson yarn, garish in the gloom, rolling across the floor. The knitting needles clattered still inside the bag, and Irene felt her skin blazing with fear and shame. How could she have been so stupid? She'd succumbed to temptation, and she was going to die for it. 4 months earlier, the federal agent had barely stifled a yawn as he swapped out the citizenship in her wrist. "We may be buying you some time, but probably not much. You know, back before computers used to give someone a new name and a new job in a new town, or they were more or less safe. Even then, too many of them made mistakes, tried to contact old friends and family, whatever. But these days, you'd more or less need a new brain to escape. If they want to find you, they will." The IV from the biometric revision had still been in her wrist while he said all that. He removed it and handed her a gauze alcohol pad. She winced as she cleaned the injection site, her fingertips smarting from the new laser prints, her eyes stinging from her new retinas. Contacts could change her blue irises to gray. She had a different hairstyle and color, a reddish-brown shag instead of her usual silver bob. A bored technician had coached her on changing her habitual fashion choices, her posture, her gait. They couldn't do anything about her height or build. "You might want to eat as much as possible to get fat," the tech said. And the feds had decreed that her case didn't warrant full-on cosmetic surgery for a new face, which was more a relief than otherwise. The agent kept talking. "Longest I've seen anybody evade a focus search is 3 months. The first guy blew it on the first day. Went to Meta News and read the articles in the same order he always did. His horoscope, and then his wife's horoscope, and then the world soccer feed, and then the political local news. The search bots must have snagged him in 15 seconds. He was dead by dinner time." Irene held up the gauze pad. "What do you want me to do with this?" He jerked his head at the red biohazard container behind him. She had to get up to put the pad inside, brushing past him in the small drab room. He grimaced in distaste. Kids these days, so squeamish about anything physical. "Well," she said, her voice tight, "I plan to be more careful than he was." He snorted. "Good luck with that. Hell of a price to pay for your principles." "No, thank you. No, you did the right thing. No, how brave you were to define Combine." She wondered whose side he was on. Maybe he was being paid off by Combine. Maybe he'd send them her new chip ID as soon as she left the room. Or maybe she was being even more paranoid than the situation warranted. Back in her seat, she looked at him carefully for the first time. He was young, barely out of his teens, with a dismissive sneer young men always seem to direct at women over 45 whenever circumstances forced them to look at such normally invisible creatures. He had net chips, of course, a relatively understated set, implanted along one temple, as commonplace now as pierced ears and noses, had been in her own day. She wondered if his red hair and freckles were original, or if he'd had to go into hiding, too, earlier in his young life. The nameplate on the agent's desk, quaintly redundant in this era of chips, read B. Jones, Citizen Protection, Mid-Atlantic Urban Corridor. Irene tried to imagine what might have brought him here. She told herself that his name was Bobby Jones, and he'd grown up in the projects somewhere. He'd filled his days with Sims and streamed entertainment and virtual violence until someone he loved, mother, father, younger sibling, was gunned down by Combine. Combine being nearly the only non-virtual game in town. And then he had faced a choice. Join Combine or fight it, because there was no ignoring it. He tried to enlist on the right side, but his cynicism bled through whenever he remembered his mother or father or younger sibling lying dead on the sidewalk in a pool of blood. Telling herself that story took Irene perhaps 30 seconds. It didn't make her feel any better about him. She looked at B. Jones again. He stared stonily back. Questions, Irene? No. Okay, well then, you're free to go. No goodbye, no good luck. He thought she was a fool. He thought she'd be dead by dinner time. Yarn rolled across the floor, the ball of red angora wobbling toward her unwelcome guest. He yelped, his voice cracking, and jumped away from it. Irene, paralyzed, realized two things. He hadn't fired the gun. He was afraid of Yarn. Afraid of Yarn? She stared at him as he stared at the Yarn. He was very young, in his teens, his pale skin blotched by acne, and his hair a dark afro. Some Combine clans maintained strict racial divisions, but most had become melting pots, recruiting and rewarding anyone whose skills contributed to their profits. He didn't yet have the eye of God. The gun no longer pointed at her, but haphazardly at a wall. It was shaking. He was shaking. He took a cautious step forward and did one swift movement, kicked the yarn away from him, back at Irene, as if it were a soccer ball. It rolled to a stop against her ankles. He was glaring at her now, and she stifled a laugh. She looked at his legs and saw a telltale bulge beneath one denim cuff. Tracker bracelet, removable only with special tools, an act of defiance that would incur heavy penalties. Combine, tick outclassed, fed tech, by orders of magnitude. Any signal this kid sent out was accessible only to his Combine bosses, as hard as the feds kept trying to crack the codes. Her visitor was a newbie, on probation. He wouldn't get the eye of God, the gaudy, permanent chip socket Combine wore in the middle of their foreheads. Recording and tracking sent straight to the higher-ups until he made his first kill. She was supposed to be his first kill. They'd sent a child to kill an old woman, but he hadn't shot her, and the gun was still shaking. "Bomb didn't blow," he said, scowling. "Some bomb." Hearing his voice, she revised her estimate of his age downward. He looked 17 or 18, but his quavering voice, cracking both from fear and from puberty, put him younger. He was better at her first language than she would have been at his. Combine communicated in a sing-songy patois, fragments of English and Spanish and Tagalog, Japanese and Russian and Arabic. "It's not a bomb," she said gently, bending to pick up the angora. "My name's Irene. How old are you?" "Know your name, lady." "I don't know yours. How old are you?" He scowled. "Don't matter. I got the gun. Bomb's broken." "It's not a bomb," she said again. "I think you're 14 or 15. Is that right?" He kept scowling, and she heard a click as his finger tightened. It occurred to her that she hadn't even thought about trying to run. She waited for noise from the gun, the last sound she would ever hear. Nothing happened. Irene held out the yarn, the precious fuzziness of angora as warm as blood. This isn't a bomb. It's yarn for knitting. Hadn't they told him anything about her? Knitting was how they'd found her, after all. She'd used a public terminal at the library. She hadn't searched on knitting or yarn, nothing so obvious. But she'd scrolled carefully through the classifieds until she'd seen the notice about crafts supplies for barter. Most of the yarn had been cheap, nasty acrylics, glittery eyelash yarn that would fall apart the second you tried to wash it. When she saw the Angora, and then the price on it, she'd known that the tired woman selling the stuff had no idea what she had. Irene hadn't set the seller straight. She felt guilty about that. The woman was just trying to eke out a living like everyone else, but not guilty enough to speak up. Even at a tenth of its true worth, the Angora was an exorbitant splurge on her tiny pension. But the yarn had called out to her like a living thing, and when she'd picked it up, she hadn't been able to make herself put it down again. Irene had thought that remaking herself would be easier. She'd shed dreams and identities before, when her parents and sister died in one of the pandemics, when her fiancé was felled by a catastrophic aneurysm. She'd gone into teaching because her classes changed every year. She told herself that would keep her from becoming too attached to the children. But B. Jones had been right. Becoming a new person was harder work than most people could manage. Irene had scrupulously avoided her old habits all summer. But as soon as fall set in, the first autumn in her life she hadn't been in a classroom as student or teacher, the yearning for familiarity grew too strong. She'd been careful, but not careful enough. The search bots must have noticed even her fractional pause at the library on the page mentioning fiber, confirmed her identity using the cameras that were everywhere now. Or maybe someone had seen her at the library or seen her in the barter zone and simply called this child to come kill her. Maybe he didn't know anything about her, about knitting, about yarn. Maybe he was just following orders. "Look," she said, and squeezed the yarn and tossed it up and down, threw it on the floor, picked it up again. "Think, Irene, be calm. See, it isn't dangerous. It's very soft. I use sticks to weave it into cloth for things like scarves and sweaters. That's called knitting." She'd very carefully avoided the word needles, which would mean only drugs to combine. He could use his chips to look up knitting on the net. For all she knew, she had only one-tenth his attention, the rest absorbed by some online game. But her best bet was to try to lure him into the physical world, her physical world, not his, a world without guns. "Here," she held out the yarn. "Would you like to touch it? It's very soft." He growled, or tried to growl, a tricycle trying to sound like a truck. "Touch it all I want after I kill you." "Sure, but then I can't answer your questions about it or show you how I use the sticks to weave it." She used her free hand to gesture to the vest she was wearing. "See this? I made this myself, with sticks and yarn." "Huh," he said, an explosive release of air. The gun wasn't shaking anymore, but it wasn't pointed at her either. He rested it casually in the crook of an arm. He looked like a curious child now, and Irene released the breath she'd been holding. He frowned, licked his lips, tilted his head, the age-old universal expression of a youngster puzzling out a problem. "You give it here again." "Sure," she said, and bent to roll the Angora across the floor. Wary, he squatted, prodding the yarn with his gun, and then with a finger. At last he picked it up, squeezing it experimentally. Something like wonder crossed his face. "Soft," he said. "Sure, I told you it was." He was patting it now. "How? Where it come from? Who makes it?" "It's from animals," she said. "Some yarn comes from sheep, but this kind comes from rabbits, from their fur. People cut the fur. It's like giving the animal a haircut, and then they spin the fur into yarn, then dye the yarn, and then people can use sticks to weave it. or they can weave it on a loom. He stared at her. Most of this was clearly beyond him. Animals? Different wonder now. Had he spent any time in school? He looked down at the yarn. Must be old. I don't know, Irene said. I don't know who made this yarn or how long ago. It could be new. He shook his head. Animals, all dead. He looked up at her and she saw emotion pass across his face. A flicker, a wisp of cloud over the sun. Seen bit of animals. He prodded the yarn again. My grandma had an animal when she was little. A little animal. Her grandma sat on an animal once. Rode it. A horse. That must have been exciting. Irene wondered what pet his grandmother had had. Cat, dog, hamster. What was your grandmother's name? Kitana, he said, voice thickening. He cradled the yarn against his chest. His face had closed again as if he regretted his steam of words. To combine enthusiasm was weakness. Irene made sure her own voice was as soft as she could make it. What happened to Kitana? Is she dead? His features were stone now, set in a sneer he'd learned from those he was trying to become. But he didn't shoot her. Don't matter, he said. You show me those sticks. She'd met Derringer 2 years before. He was the smallest and shyest student in her fourth grade class. And his parents were certainly Columbine, who always named their children after weapons. Irene had resigned herself to living in a culture where killers didn't even try to disguise themselves. Every year she told herself that the lessons she taught about listening, about compassion, themes she wove through more conventional math and reading lessons might make a difference. She told herself that being around non-Combine kids might make a difference. Derringer was one of the lucky ones. Plenty of Combine parents kept their children out of school entirely, a situation the state had long since stopped challenging. Social services didn't visit Combine homes. The body count was too high. To her surprise and pleasure, Derringer had clearly been homeschooled before he came to her classroom. He wasn't much behind the other children, and he caught up rapidly. He loved to read, loved to write stories he illustrated himself. Irene's classroom had computers, and many of her students already had net chips, although Derringer didn't. But she blocked network access in her classroom and made her students work with tangible objects. Pencil, crayon, paper, scissors, glue. She wanted them to learn to manipulate objects with mass, to savor the physical. Derringer's stories were about guns and money and people dying in bloody street battles. The tales broke Irene's heart, but his facility in spinning them gave her hope. She began challenging him to tell happier stories. What would happen if those people didn't use their guns, Derringer?
If they used their fists? He squinted at her. Bullets quicker.
Yes, I know, but what if they didn't use weapons? What if they decided to do something else instead? To help each other with laundry? To share a meal? He giggled. That don't happen, you silly. Sometimes it's okay to tell silly stories. What if?
The story finished, he said decisively. Want to do fractions now.
He liked math. He was good at it. He was smart. He never seemed comfortable around the other students, but first thing each morning and last thing each afternoon, he ran to Irene for a hug, and he sat next to her during story time whenever he could, leaning against her as if she were a tree. She'd kept her early vow not to get too attached to her kids, especially Combine kids. But she loved Derringer. She couldn't help it. Many of the other students were dropped off and picked up by adults or older siblings. But Derringer was a school bus child who survived and arrived and left by himself every day. And Irene found herself imagining reasons. The adults he lived with ignored him, let him do what he wanted. They were too caught up in street trade to mind him, and so he decided on his own to come to school. Rationally, Irene knew this couldn't be true. Derringer was clean, well-fed, always neatly dressed in clothing appropriate for the season. He arrived in her classroom able to read, act, add, subtract. Someone at home cared about him. and so she imagined his mother or an aunt teaching him his ABCs and 1 plus 1s, while the rest of his clan weighed out ounces and kilos or haggled over territorial disputes. Combine, supposedly one entity, was in fact as fractured as the wooden oranges Irene used to teach her students halves and quarters. Clans competed for sales and status, for the recognition of their big bosses, who lived in posh suburbs, and hired attorneys and consultants to manage their corporate interests. Big bosses died, too, in backyard assassinations or golf course drive-bys, but not nearly as often as the street soldiers did. Here in the city, the trade in drugs, weapons, sex was no less dangerous than it had ever been. Average lifespan in inner-city combine clans was 35. Parent-teacher night fell on the first crisp week of fall. Irene wore a hand-knitted sweater to class that day and noted approvingly that Derringer was bundled in a fleece jacket. She had formed an image of the female relative who cared for him so tenderly, a smiling gray-haired presence who used drug money to buy good clothing for Derringer, who spent hours coaching him on basic skills. But when Derringer gave Irene her goodbye hug that afternoon, he said, "My daddy tell you he be here tonight. He tell you not be scared." Irene blinked. "Your father?" Derringer pointed solemnly at the unmarked skin in the middle of his forehead. "He have I don't want you to be scared." "That's very kind of him," Irene said, more than a little startled. And it was. If an Eye of God combine parent had shown up in her classroom with no warning, she'd have been terrified. "Please tell your father I'm looking forward to meeting him." She wondered if he'd actually show. Few parents of any occupation came to parent-teacher night. Most teachers used the occasion to visit, gossip, do paperwork. Irene planned to bring knitting, a lace shawl. But sure enough, she looked up from her patterns to find a blockily built, black-clad figure in her classroom doorway. "Miss Irene," Eye of God glinted in his forehead, ordinary net chips arrayed on either side of it. He had crimped blonde hair, epicanthic folds, the burly build of a football player. He stepped forward and held out his hand for Irene to shake, civilian style. Combine clans had elaborate can codes and recognition symbols and signals, but he was very carefully, she saw, trying to follow her protocols. "Glock, you teach my boy Derringer." "I'm very glad and pleased to meet you, Glock." His handshake was firm but somewhat moist. Was he nervous, this combine giant? Every movement controlled, he seated himself in front of her desk and held out a piece of paper. "Derringer, he just got this report." Irene took the printout, looked at it. "Derringer's midterm grades." She smiled at Glock. "Yes, all A's. He's an excellent student." "Truly?" She blinked. "Why, yes, he's a very bright little boy." Glock shook his head. "Truly, though? The A's real? Not fear A's because of who we are, who I am?" He gestured to the Eye. "He really earning them?" Irene sucked in a breath and tried not to stare, but she supposed Glock had a point. If Derringer hadn't been a good student, would she have been nervous about marking him down, afraid of reprisals? Would it have occurred to her that a combine parent even cared? "Yes," she said, "truly, he came here with very good homeschooling, and he's blossomed in the classroom. He's very intelligent." Glock's face relaxed a little, and Irene risked a question. "Who taught him at home? Did you?" "What I know," he looked down anyway, "didn't get far me." "You're a good teacher," she told him, and meant it. "You did a good job, and you seem to have given him study habits, not simply information. That's the best thing you could have done." Glock looked up, looked surprised, flashed a smile. "Truly?" But the smile faded before Irene could answer. "You think he's smart enough to go high school?" Good Lord, Irene had never heard of a city combine child pursuing formal education past junior high. And Glock was Eye of God, monitored and monitoring 24/7. Wouldn't this be taken as an admission that he was trying to free his child from Combine? Or would his higher-ups see these plans as an admirable, if audacious, bid for big bossdom, preparation for a slightly safer future? Glock looked nervous again. Irene leaned forward, making eye contact, and said firmly, "Sir, your son is smart enough to do absolutely anything he wants." Derringer, glowing, bounced up to her next morning. He pulled Irene down to whisper in her ear, "Daddy think you nice." "I think he's nice, too," she said. And for a wonder, it was true. The little she knew of the man, she didn't want to know any more. He cared about his child and tried to be a good father. That was enough. Derringer sped through the next few months of schoolwork. During winter break, Irene saw something online about a city combine massacre, but there were always combine massacres. She ignored the story and continued her search for pumpkin pie recipes. In January, Derringer didn't come back to school. The first few days he was absent, Irene told herself he must be ill. It was flu season, after all. Blessedly, there hadn't yet been a new pandemic this year, and although Derringer had never missed school before, there had to be a first time for everything. But when he'd been out a week, her simmering worry rose to the surface, and she went to the school office to see if anyone knew anything. It was possible that Glock had called the office to explain, and the message hadn't reached her. "No messages," said the administrative aide. "I'd have given you a message." She was a tiny woman, plump and sagging and permanently aggrieved, with meticulously maintained dreadlocks and long, festively painted fingernails. She wasn't paid enough, and only people sought her out when they were upset about something. "I just wanted to ask, Nancy. I know how busy you are. We all drop some balls sometimes. It's only human. Can you look up the student's home contact information for me, please? Derringer Kiwa?" "Derringer?" Nancy squinted at her. "And you want to call him at home?" "I've met his father. It's fine." Nancy raised her eyebrows. "It's your funeral." She printed out a sheet of paper, "Absolute Tech, dictated by the school's dismal budget," and handed it to Irene. "Good luck." "Thank you," Irene said. She used her mobile to call the number as soon as she got back to her classroom. It had been disconnected. That evening, she went to the library to do a net search on Glock Kiwa. She didn't want to do it at home. She couldn't afford to have Combine notice her curiosity. She probably shouldn't have made the phone call either, even though she'd been Derringer's teacher. She found the news story almost instantly. Glock had been killed in the latest massacre, a matter of staggering bankrolls in Byzantine politics. Glock's Crater clan feuding with Scar clan, which had tried to encroach on Crater turf with the support of several other groups. The report didn't mention Glock's son, and Irene's throat tightened with dread. If Glock had taken anyone else before he was killed, or even if he hadn't, the other clans would seek retribution. Relatives, especially children, were favored targets. Library terminal swam in front of her eyes. Where was Derringer now? Was he still alive, mourning the father who loved him? She scrolled through other news stories about the bloodbath, but saw no mention of a dead child. Lying in bed that night, staring tensely into darkness, Irene tried to imagine a happy ending. She told herself that maybe a kind aunt or grandmother from another state had been at the funeral and taken Derringer away to live with her, and they hadn't told the school. She told herself that Derringer had run away to escape the violence. He could have snagged a few bills of drug money and gotten on a bus and gone somewhere he knew people. He was good at geography, and Irene always taught her students how to find safe houses. She tried to tell herself that he could be living with some adult across town now in another school altogether. She didn't believe any of it. Derringer might just as well have sprouted wings and flown away. She knew she'd never see him again. She was opening the classroom windows on a warm April morning, really the first fine weather they'd had since winter, when she felt a tug on her hand. "Miss Irene,"
She recognized the voice, even in a whisper. Otherwise, she might not have recognized the child. He was wearing a shirt that had been his favorite last autumn, but now it was too small for him and torn. His skin was crusty around the eyes and mouth, and a mottled bruise covered one cheek. She dropped to a crouch, hugging him. She'd come to work early, and no other children had arrived yet. The boy smelled terrible, like sour milk and dirty diapers and dead animals. Irene tried not to gag. "Derringer, I'm so glad you're here. I've missed you." "Ran away," he said. His voice was slurred, and she wondered if he was on drugs. "You said we could run away and be safe." Oh, God. She knew she should call social services, but she didn't want Derringer treated like a number. He'd come to her because he trusted her. She called the office, pleaded sudden illness, and led Derringer outside to her car. She didn't even want to think about how many laws she was breaking or who might be watching her on the cameras dotted around the city streets. Some were broken. Too many weren't. She went home. She didn't know where else to go. She fixed him a grilled cheese sandwich and tomato soup, watched while he devoured the food, and finally coaxed the story from him, bit by bit. The people who'd killed his father had found Derringer and taken him as a war trophy. They'd put him to work as a drug lookout, but he ran away. They found him again, and now they kept him chained inside an apartment. He wouldn't tell her what had happened there. When she asked, he shrank in on himself, shuddering, and she couldn't bear to press him. He'd managed to pick the padlock or stolen a key from someone nodding out at the kitchen table. That part was garbled by terror. And found his way to a train that stopped near school. "You keep me safe," he said, his eyes huge and glazed and pleading. "I stay with you." "Sweetie, I can't." She couldn't let herself cry. Her throat hurt. "I wish I could, but it wouldn't be safe for either of us. I want you to be safe, Derringer. You have to go somewhere completely different." She wanted to give him a bath, wanted to buy him new clothing, wanted to read to him and rock him to sleep. She couldn't do any of that, couldn't take the time. The people from whom he'd escaped would be looking. Maybe she and Derringer were already discovered, already doomed. She'd been stupid to come back here, but she hadn't known what else to do. She bundled him in one of her old sweaters, which had shrunk in the wash. She took him to a safe house, where the intake volunteer, a dark-skinned woman with a pitted face and kind eyes, promised that he'd be moved out of the city far away, somewhere his captors couldn't track him. The safe houses functioned like the old underground railroad, each stop on the route knowing the location of the next stop, but nothing after that. Irene left Derringer there, both of them weeping. She made him promise that he'd keep going to school, that he'd work hard. "Your father wanted you to go to high school, Derringer. I want that, too. I know you'll make us proud. I know you'll make a good life for yourself." She left him there. She went back home. She knew it was dangerous, but she was drained, unable to think, her earlier losses rising to haunt her. Face wet with tears, she lay awake in the dark, tensing whenever the old building creaked. The next morning, the news reported that the safe house had been raided by Combine overnight. Everyone in the building was dead. She had no idea how they could have known Derringer was there, but if they knew that, they knew other things. Irene packed a suitcase with clothing, some of her best yarn and knitting needles, photographs of her parents, her sister, her fiancé. She had no photo of Derringer except the ones seared into her brain. She left all her keys on the kitchen table. She didn't dare try to drive anywhere because they might have her license plate, and car bombs were all too common, and walked, mouth dry and heart pounding, to the nearest police station, where she asked for asylum. His name was Wesson. He spent an hour with Irene that first visit, watching her work her needles, listening to her explain what she was doing. "Casting on, knitting, purling. This is a yarn over, Wesson. I can use it to make lace, see?" She knitted a few repetitions of feather and fan, and he grinned with delight when the rolling scallop design revealed itself. Then she demonstrated cables. That first visit, he refused to put down his gun. that at the end of the hour he said, "Gotta go now, be back." Irene swallowed, shook her head. "Won't you get in trouble for not killing me?" He shrugged. "No, I. They don't know, for sure, not for sure." "You have the tracking bracelet. Won't they know you were here for a long time?" He shrugged again. "Maybe. Yeah, I guess." "When will you come back?" A third shrug. "Dunno, when I can." After he'd left, she paced and pondered. Should she flee? But where would she go? It would only be more of the same. And if they found her once, they could find her again. The assassin they sent next time might well be older and more experienced, more immune to wonder. If she stayed, they'd still send someone else. Surely nothing good would happen to Wesson, who hadn't completed his assigned task. Just in case, she dug through her tiny stash and found some precious superwash wool. Bright red. Enough, yes. When Wesson came back a few days later, still toting his oversized gun, she had one sock finished. "Here, try this on. It's a man's large. I had to guess at your size, but if that one fits, I'll make a second for you. If it doesn't, I'll start over." He pulled off his massive sneaker and tried the sock on. It fit. He grinned, wiggled his toes, walked around in it. "Feels good. Warm." "Good. I'll make the second one then." "You show me how." So she did, demonstrating the cast-on for a toe-up sock on 4 double-pointed needles. As he was about to leave, she said quietly, "Wesson, what are you telling them about me?" "Nothing," he said, suddenly sullen, frowning and ferocious. "Ain't telling them nothing. Won't you get into trouble?" He looked away, stony. I tell them you have to finish my sock, then I kill you." "Right," she thought, but he was gone. She finished the second sock and started a scarf, wondering when she'd see him again, wondering if she'd see him or the next assassin at all, or simply collapse in a spray of blood from a bullet to the back of her head. When Wesson came back the next time, he didn't have his gun. Instead, he handed her a pair of drumsticks. "These my aunt's. She plays drums once. Show me knit on them." She gave him a pair of her old knitting needles instead. She taught him to cast on, knit, purl. He was a quick learner, good with his hands. By the end of that lesson, she'd given him the scarf to finish. After that, he showed up every few days. Irene felt like Scheherazade, although the tales she wove were in wool, not words. By late October, Wesson had finished the scarf, only his first few inches uneven, and wore it proudly. He made another feather and fan for his aunt. He asked Irene if she could teach him to knit socks. All the while, he still wore the tracking bracelet. The Tuesday before Thanksgiving, still celebrated with family feasts, Irene spent a small fortune on vat-grown chicken breast and shared it with Wesson, who brought her 3 apples. Fruit was precious now, a princely gift only Combine could afford. On the winter solstice, he arrived with a tiny piece of real chocolate for her, and Irene gave him some hand-knitted mittens. She hadn't had enough matching yarn to provide to work the same pattern in each, but they seemed to delight him. She allowed herself to be lulled into a fragile sense of safety. Wesson clearly had no more interest in killing her. His superiors, who had to know what was happening, were obviously tolerating the situation. She was certain it was a temporary reprieve. They were Combine. They knew where she lived. They could kill her and Wesson whenever they wanted to, which was surely why they hadn't insisted that he kill her immediately. Somewhere, someone was amused by this situation. She might have been, too, if her life hadn't been at stake. She remained alive only at the whim of powers beyond her control. But hadn't that always been true? And she'd missed teaching, missed working with children, showing Wesson how to knit helped ease that ache. She knew in her gut that she'd be dead by spring. Whenever she imagined her death, it occurred in April, the month Derringer had died. However short this grace period might be, it was a blessing. And then, one freezing day in January, Wesson, beaming, bundled in his scarf, and a hat he'd made, and her mismatched mittens, walked into her apartment and said, "Animals. Want to go see 'em?" "What?" Irene had been fighting a cold, praying it wasn't flu or something worse. There were rumors of another pandemic this year, something in Canada that had surely already spread to the States. Every muscle ached. She didn't want to go anywhere. Wesson pulled a piece of paper out of the pocket of his puffy down jacket. "Animals at the old zoo. Thought you wouldn't see it online, so printed this, see?" She sneezed and peered at the paper. She needed new bifocals, but couldn't afford them. She squinted at the tiny print of the news story. A temporary exhibit at the old petting zoo. Some goats and sheep, a guinea pig and a rabbit, all cloned and vat-grown. One of the universities was raising money by taking them on the road. The admission charge was astronomical. Irene sighed. "Wesson, I'm sick. I don't want to go outside. You shouldn't be with me, breathing my germs, and I can't afford this. I'm sorry. You go and tell me about it. I afford it. Not afraid to get sick. Come on, Rene. Come see sheep with me." He was almost dancing from foot to foot, childlike as she'd ever seen him. She swallowed. It was below freezing out, and she didn't have a coat. She hadn't thought to bring one with her when she fled in April, and she didn't have the money for one now, and she was sick. "It's too cold," she said, nearly weeping. "Wesson, I'm sorry, truly." Oh, he said, looking stricken. "You make all these warm things." He stopped, chewed his lip, and then grinned. "Nah, we fix it. Easy." He insisted that she wear his down jacket, in which she swam like a doll wrapped in a king-size comforter. He draped himself in his scarf, two of her own scarves, and her one blanket. "I return it, promise," and then drew himself up majestically. "I look like sheep pusher?" "Sheep pusher?" She stared at him blankly. Was this a fever dream? How sick was she? "Oh, a shepherd, you mean. Couldn't he have learned the right word online? What did he do with those net chips, other than streaming the pounding ammo pop favored by Combine? He looked nothing like a shepherd, but she didn't want to disabuse him. He was a child, but still a singularly dangerous one." "Why, yes, I believe you do," he grinned. "Subway car be warmer." It was indeed warmer, although they had to wait too long on the freezing platform. By the time the train came, groaning and creaking in a chorus of ancient complaints, Irene had succumbed to a bone-deep shivering that felt like all her joints were grating together. She was surprised she didn't clatter when she walked. The car was full of Combine soldati, a gang of them, black-suited, sullen, ankles bulging, guns on laps, hands and feet jittering as they listened to their music. Irene was grateful she couldn't hear it. There were no eyes here, but it was still bad. She wondered how many clans were represented. The sigils were visible only on certain wavelengths, detected by the net chips. Better not to know, maybe. Wesson had to be Scar Clan, the people who killed Sklok, but she never asked him. "I'm going to die now," she thought. In the moment before the door closed, she thought about trying to run. But how far would she get? She glanced at Wesson, who looked cheerfully unconcerned. Had he led her into this trap, or had he been surprised by it? She sat down, closing her ordinary flesh-and-blood eyes, and leaning forward, trying to stop shaking, waiting once again for bullets. Instead, she heard Wesson chattering with the other young men in Combine dialect. If she opened her eyes, she'd see their hands flying, fingers flashing in the jive that contained at least half the content of each sentence. She didn't open her eyes. Wesson's voice sounded conversational enough, but Irene didn't know if she could trust her instincts. She tried to pick out individual words, but they kept blurring together, and then she heard one. Grandmother. Grandmother. Had Wesson said that? Had one of the others? She wasn't even sure. But when Irene opened her eyes, the soldati were blinking at her, muttering to each other. And then the car stopped, and Wesson said, "This be us," and tugged her upright and out onto the platform. She could have sworn the tufts pulled away from her as she passed. Making her way up another steep staircase, aching and winded, Irene managed words. "Wesson, your grandmother, Katana, what happened to her?" Even through his improbable shepherd's outfit, she saw his shoulders hunch. "She dead." "I'm sorry, Wesson." Irene imagined a white-haired woman rocking an infant grandson. Imagined the woman telling the child when he was older about a pet she'd had once, a real live animal, warm and furry, a creature made of more than ones and zeros. "How did she die?" He pulled the scarves around his face. They were on the street now, in biting wind. "She just die," he said, voice muffled by wool. "She old. She just stop." "You must have been very sad. So few people died of simple old age anymore, even if they weren't connected to Combine." Irene hugged Wesson's jacket closer. "It was damn cold out here. And what were the university types thinking, subjecting precious creatures to this weather? They must really be desperate for funding, although that had been true as long as Irene could remember. How old were you when she died?" 10. Irene heard the shudder in his voice. "Went to wake her for breakfast, her mouth all open, her hands all stiff." "You found her? Wesson, I'm sorry. My grandma died 50 years ago, and I still miss her sometimes." "Yeah," he said. But now they were at the gate of the zoo, and someone official-looking scanned one of Wesson's chips twice, and they both had antiseptic gel squirted onto their hands, and then they were inside. The petting zoo had been covered with a tent, and to Irene's immense relief, there were heaters inside. She and Wesson stopped next to one to thaw their fingers and faces. Then they made their way to the small group of cages. "That it?" Wesson said excitedly, pointing at an animal. "That the sheep?" "No, that's a goat." Hadn't he seen photos? Entranced, Irene knelt down in front of the cage. The goat, very young, really a kid, backed up and tried to butt her, bouncing instead off the plexiglass of its cage. "He trying hurt you?" Wesson sounded as indignant as if he were her assigned killer. "He's playing. Or she." Irene scanned the docent card, printed in very low tech, attached to the cage. "Nope, you were right. He's a boy. Look at his eyes, Wesson. See those slits? Isn't he funny looking?" Wesson had knelt next to her. Irene thought of the old stories about the baby born in the stable, the animals kneeling in reverence to honor incarnation. Now humans were the ones kneeling to animals. "We touch them?" "No," Irene said sadly. "They're too afraid. We'll make the animals sick. That's why we had to wash our hands coming in. But we can't touch them even so. We can only look." The aching in her bones and joints and chest had deepened. She shouldn't be here, or she might infect these impossibly rare creatures. "Aw," said Wesson. He put his hand against the plastic, and the kid tried to butt it, and Wesson laughed. "He funny." "Yes, he is." Her voice sounded thick to her, froggy. "Think I felt heat from him. He really real?" "He really is." They watched the goat a while and then moved to the guinea pig. "Potato with fur," Wesson sniffed, unimpressed. "And then to the sheep." "Cloud with legs," Wesson said, his voice lightened by joy. And Irene allowed herself a brief fantasy about what he might have become with proper education. There weren't many people here, not nearly as many as Irene would have expected, even with the weather and the exorbitant admission price. Well, anyone could see animals on the internet. If you couldn't touch them, what was the point? The animals, so closed off and walled in, filled her with sorrow. Head aching, she found herself fighting tears, even when Wesson, who had gone off to find a restroom, yelled across the tent, "Reen, rabbit, look at them ears. That's the animal your urine came from, yeah?" She'd go see the rabbit. She'd tell Wesson how fast rabbits were, how they had to be fast because everything hunted them. And then she'd told him she had to go home because she was sick and because she couldn't stand the cages anymore. Crossing the tent, she had to make her way around a man carrying a little girl on her shoulders. The child wore shiny pink butterfly barrettes on her cornrows,
and cased in a quilted powder-blue snowsuit, she beat on the man's head with dimpled hands, singing a nonsense song. Irene, temporarily charmed out of her despair, turned to see the child's face. Instead, she saw the glint of metal, round, surrounded with inset red and white crystals. Eye of God. The man, father, brother, uncle, whatever, was Eye of God Combine. Irene's stomach lurched. She faced swiftly forward again, praying he hadn't seen her, hoping, too, that he hadn't noticed Wesson. Although it was all too likely that he was here because of Wesson, having used the ankle cuff to track the two of them to the zoo. She and Wesson had never left her apartment together before. That might have, must have, annoyed some watcher, crossed some line. The grace period was over. Wesson had returned to the display. He stared at the bunny, his hand flat against the plastic. "Deaf worm," he said wistfully. And Irene was about to tell him that the rabbit didn't matter now, that other things were more important, that they had company, when his face went tense, and a hiss came from between his teeth. "Wesson?" But he held up a hand to quiet her, put it on her shoulder. "Stay." And she did. She didn't know what else to do. "Your building," he said, when he came back from wherever he'd been. "Newsfeed. Your building burning. Green. Because of me? Your people?" A grim nod from Wesson. "Yeah, Scar Clan. Same as Safe House. Scar Sig. Firebomb. Derringer." Her gut twisted. "Derringer trapped in fire, screaming." "No. Focus, Irene. That nightmare's in the past. You have problems right here, right now. What are you going to do?" "You can't do anything." "Wesson," she said, "they followed us here. I, behind you." No sooner had she said it than she heard a joyous shriek from the little girl. "Bunny Daddy, pat the bunny, pat the bunny, pat the bunny." The book, Pat the Bunny, with all its shapes and textures. Do parents still read that to their children? Combine parents? Wesson turned, his back against hers, pressing her gently against the plastic of the cage. He was shielding her, this improbable shepherd, for all the good it would do either of them. On the other side of the plastic, the rabbit hopped away toward its water bottle. Smart bunny. Irene saw the crowing child and her expressionless, terrifying father reflected in the smooth surface. She imagined tomorrow's headline, "Massacre at Non-Petting Zoo." She and Wesson would be dead. The plastic would probably be shattered. She hoped the rabbit at least would be safe. The father's reflection smiled, pointed at the bunny, spoke to his daughter. "Look, Bertha. See it hop? Hop on its little leg?" He tickled her through the snowsuit, his fingers beating a tattoo against the blue nylon. Bertha giggled and pulled his hat down over his forehead, over the eye. The father nodded, hands moving in a blur of jive, and Wesson stepped away, allowing Irene to turn around. She gaped up at the covered eye, Bertha's hands firmly over the hat, which was over the eye. Wesson's hands and the father's flew through intricate conversation. Irene's hands shook helplessly. The father unzipped his jacket, withdrew a thick envelope and some sort of wrench, and gave them to Wesson, who thrust them quickly beneath the blanket. The father reached out and touched Irene's shoulder. She flinched, but the touch was gentle, a caress. And then he turned and walked away, and Wesson was pulling Irene in the other direction, away from the eye, away from giggling Bertha, away from her father, whose voice reached them faintly. "Goat, Bertha. Billy goat." Then they were outside again, and Wesson was pushing her into a van. Combine black, all right. So now she'll die. But she found herself sinking into warm leather, heard Wesson exhale in relief beside her. They were alone in the back seat. The van was moving, although the front seat was empty. GPS auto guidance, pre-programmed. It would take them somewhere deadly if it didn't simply explode. "Safe," Wesson said. He bent down, pulled up the cuff of his jeans, and used the wrench, glowing blue from embedded electronics, to remove his tracking bracelet. It came off with a small click. He unrolled the car window and tossed both objects into the frigid wind before closing the window again. "We're safe, rarer than rabbit, Green.
What? But he was grinning as he passed her the thick envelope from Bertha's father. She fumbled it open and found two printed train passes. Paper and ink, those anachronistic extravagances. Good for unlimited trips. We go anywhere, Wesson said. She didn't understand. She shook the rest of the envelope's contents onto her lap. Hard currency, more priceless than Angora. And there was a lot of it here. And something else. A photograph of two children. A baby, fat and laughing, with yellow flower barrettes on her cornrows, sitting on the lap of an older boy, 4 or 5 maybe. Features achingly familiar. He held the book. He was reading it to her. Pat the Bunny. The photograph's side bore indentations. It had been in a frame once. A precious physical relic. Irene turned over the photograph and found an inscription painted on the back in neat block letters. Bertha and Derringer. Bertha, first birthday. And below that, in awkward script, thank you, Grandmother. The letters swam. Irene said. Manitzu, Derringer, uncle. Nothing made sense. He's Crater Clan? Why didn't he kill you? Why couldn't he help Derringer when... Wesson shook his head. Out of the country then. Glock told him about you before he left. Came back, bribed feds, tracked you, protected us. From your people? Scar Clan? How? Wesson shrugged. Bribes? Threats, maybe? Didn't say. Not much time. You, me, Derringer, small caliber. Bosses have bigger problems. Did you know they were going to firebomb my apartment? Did he? No, would have warned you. He sounded genuinely hurt. But then he shuddered. Maybe meant for both of us. Lucky we were out. Derringer, uncle, saw fire. Knew, had package ready. Programmed van. He taught Bertha to cover his eye of God, Irene said numbly. She both admired his audacity and was horrified that he was using his daughter despite his obvious love for her. How long had he been planning this? Reeling, she looked down at the back of the photograph. Thank you, Grandmother. And then it hit her. The thing that should have been obvious all along. The thing that had been staring at her in the face. Since Glock came to parent-teacher night. Since the first time she met Wesson and listened to him talk about Katana. Combine knew death ultimately. Traded it, created it. Saw it stark and bloody and howling in front of them. Because they dealt in death, at least some of them treasured life. Most Combine parents, like all parents, loved their children. Most Combine parents, like all parents, wanted their children to outlive them. Glock had loved Derringer. Derringer's uncle had loved Derringer and loved Bertha. He had extended grace, even across clan lines, to Wesson, who hadn't killed the old woman, who had tried to save his nephew. The old woman who could show Combine children and their parents that people could still live to be old. Grandmother, when the life expectancy of your community is 35, a grandmother is a figure of fear and wonder. You rarer than rabbit, Rain. To be Joan, she had been invisible. The Combine didn't even need Eye of God to see her. Even the kids in the subway car, distracted by music and the ever-present net, had seen her. The van had stopped. It had brought them to one of the older train stations. Had Derringer's uncle somehow blocked the cameras here or acted on knowledge that things were broken? Exactly how much had he engineered? And if he could do all that, why wasn't he sending them somewhere safe? But she knew the answer. There were no safe places. The only safety lay in movement. Her building was burning, had burned. She hoped no other people burned with it. She was sick and exhausted. She didn't want to run, but that was what rabbits did. And now she had young to guard. Wesson had put everything back into the envelope. We look ridiculous, she told him. As soon as possible, we have to get off the train and buy some proper clothing. Nah, he said, his voice buoyant. We ride the train till spring. He reached for the door handle, and in the distance, Irene heard the scream of metal on rails.